It's Thursday, March 23rd, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Orlando, Florida. Well, hello from relatively warm Orlando. I've actually been hanging out with some folks from Nebraska this week who left over a foot of snow on the ground. But last night in the trolley, I was with some Canadians from northern Saskatchewan who had over 6 feet of snow on the ground. So it's quite pleasant to be here in Orlando in March, and it was a little cooler last night, but we actually wore shorts the night before out to dinner. So quite a bit different than living in the northern Midwest, or obviously if you live in Canada. Today's podcast, though, isn't about weather. It is about storytelling. And Joe Lambert, who is the co-founder of the Center for Digital Storytelling that is located in Berkeley, California, is the speaker and the presenter. He was our keynote speaker at the SITE conference here in Orlando yesterday. And this is not Joe's keynote, but it's actually a dialogue which followed his keynote for an hour. And he generously gave permission for me to record this and share it. And he's simply responding to questions and answers that educators at a variety of different levels, but primarily higher education and colleges of education, had about digital storytelling and the compelling role that digital storytelling can play as a curricular activity and really as an activity of our lives. And the websites that Joe talked about, including the Murmur website, I will go ahead and link in the podcast show notes. But really the best place to get information about digital storytelling is to visit their Center for Digital Storytelling website, which I'll also include a link to. As I think I've probably said here before in podcasts, storytelling is one of these things that we can get centered around because it's such a broad topic. That's one of the reasons that it was selected as a strand for a pre-conference blog for the SITE conference. Pretty much irrespective of the content area that you teach or the age of the students that you teach, digital storytelling is something that you can do. Another session I attended yesterday, but because it was 2 hours long, I'm going to have to edit it later and really chunk it into different pieces, was digital storytelling across the core content areas. And we had presentations about digital storytelling in pre-K classrooms, storytelling in science classrooms, in math classrooms, social studies, and language arts. And it really is just this wonderful topic and subject that a lot of us can get centered on. And as Joe talks about, oftentimes when people focus on turning points or transition points in their lives, those points can actually be very compelling times in our lives when we reflect and tell a story about what happened. And we can't necessarily do that right away or when we're in the middle of that transition point, but after we get some distance from that, we can effectively reflect and tell that story. So here is Joe Lambert, as well as educators from the SITE conference, which is the Society for Information Technology and Education here in Orlando, Florida, and this was a presentation on March 22nd, 2006.
Well, thank you guys for coming. I'm sorry I got way late over there. Somebody should have dragged you. One of you should have dragged me away. Normal thing. So this was ostensibly a chance to debrief and discuss more of these issues. Obviously, I would love to hear from you about what the talk brought up, and it's an unusual format for me, so I haven't gotten to follow up a speech with a debriefing, so I'm ready for that. So we'll start with you, Sean.
I work with, I do a lot of work with this format. One of the groups that I work with is K-12 school residential group that works with really troubled youth. Mm-hmm. And I shared the idea recently when looking at some grant opportunities with them about this whole idea of digital storytelling and the need for our kids to tell their stories as part of the healing process, mm-hmm. and the growing process. Mm-hmm. And showed them a little story, I guess, that I told one of my kids. Mm-hmm. Showed them, had them both in tears, mm-hmm. And myself in tears. And what I want to know, I really want to engage and to take this back to them and say, look, I got to hear your talk. Mm-hmm. And I want an action plan, mm-hmm. that you know, they're going to need machines as well to get this kind of project done.
Right.
And so, any thoughts on the plan? Obviously, you guys have a curriculum or a training process. Any thoughts on all of that?
And I'm willing to bet there are people maybe in this room that are implement. I'm looking for Bernard, whose name I forgot.
Forgive me.
Oh, it's John.
Yeah. Now we're even. I was like, God, I can't do this. There are many people in the room that have been assisting school districts in implementations. We've certainly done that on many different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the one, you know, quick thought is so much of this work is not about the computer.
Mm-hmm.
The pre-organization to the computer and then running production through, we have teachers who have done it on one computer with 32 students. So can it be done? Yes, it can be done. It's kind of like military organization at that level. Maybe that's not even a good metaphor for our military, but, you know, the idea of you kind of create a system when the person's ready, they're on the computer to do the computer work. And
sure.
But certainly classrooms with four computers and 30 students, that's a doable situation. But the other thing that I think teachers and non-professional audiovisual, you know, people doing multimedia production, they screw up the audio. And getting a voice override and creating a safe place and quiet place to do voiceover work is to me a kind of critical component, because if you hear artifact in the sound, poor recording, it takes away so much of the power of the work. So I didn't bring it in my backpack, but I'm carrying this Samson mic. So here's a suggestion. One kit item. These USB mics have finally gotten pretty good. And they're just plug and play instead of using mixer. Historically, we've used mixer systems mainly to control the fact that you have little voices and really big voices, and so you need to use a mixer to kind of affect the gain or the volume control in and out. But these mics are reasonably sensitive enough, and as long as you put a windscreen on them or a big sock on top of the mic, then you can usually get a pretty good consistent voice. And then, you know, then just find a closet in an office or in the bathroom. I've recorded in all situations where you get a nice, quiet, you know, small room feel. And those are the issues. I mean, just, I think it is what you mean on, you know, the curriculum level. It's really about the kind of system of getting the writing out of people, creating the assets, images, and the recording of voice, video if you're going to use it, etc. Assembling those assets in a central place and then allowing the edit to take place. And the edit can be PowerPoint or any number of other tools. The list goes on forever. And new ones are being developed by this group today. So, yeah.
We just have people stand as they speak. Before.
Yeah, we're having a little hard time in the rest of the room. It's a big room to do this in.
Okay.
Jessica?
I was wondering, in Ohio we have very stringent standards that we have to follow and a lot of high-stakes testing that our budgets rely on.
Yep.
So how could we successfully use digital storytelling but also be able to meet all of our standards in all of our content areas and have our kids pass those tests?
Despite all jokes against No Child Left Behind. I mean, we have seen what I've always felt is any professional in any world that creates mechanisms that are reasonable mechanisms of quality control, creative people find ways to integrate things that are useful for the students to do that. Obviously, in almost every state of the union, I believe in middle school level now, it used to be high school, but it's middle school level, creating a multimedia presentation is itself a standard, if I'm not mistaken. They're supposed to have done PowerPoint by eighth grade in many states, and increasingly the exit standards include some sort of approach. So on just the basic level is, do they say what you have to do inside that? No. You know, so you're teaching the technology, and the argument that you're teaching a technology using this method of storytelling, whatever kind of story, but, you know, this is. From there, if we go around the room, I'm sure we'd have several people who are successfully integrating this into, I mean, I know the presentations here in math, certainly in social sciences, the writing can be to history, to any number of forms that can nail the standard, and this is just the output. My own son turned in his book report on the Loch Ness Monster as a digital story, and it worked perfectly for the requirement of his writing. In some ways, it was just taking the essay and making a short film out of the essay. So, to me, that's a way to bring that in very specifically to standards. Obviously, the mapping of the standards, Helen Barrett in the house someplace at the conference here, is someone at helenbarrett.com who spent a lot of time thinking both in terms of the e-portfolio movement, but now in terms of digital storytelling, about mapping that work into the standards. I also could recommend the ALI environment, Apple Learning Interchange, has several projects as excellent design examples. I love the one that they did with the New Deal painting of the Underground Railway project, in which students did digital stories, and they map it directly into standards in a really effective way, as do all of 30 or 40 projects on AI.
I think Bernard Jean Porter has done
Bernard Jean, absolutely, yeah. And Bernard Jean's got a book out that talks about the mapping of this into this, based in Colorado. So,
what's that name again?
Bernard Jean Porter. Wave the book in the air.
All of
just
these,
because I was reading it this morning.
Yeah.
And these are all mentioned in the blog.
Right, they are. They're all on the blog.
Bernard Jean's actually contributed the link to Helen's website.
And we've got a ton of links to a lot of information about. Yeah.
If you go to the website's homepage, just go to the conference homepage and see Site Live. You click that on, and that takes you to the three blogs. I want to just offer another perspective on this. I don't think there's a group in the country that can address that issue better. I'm a little less optimistic than Joe is about this. I do know that NCLB is a real problem, and I know there are some teachers that will find a great deal of difficulty. But if we, all the teacher educators, and it's part of what the group this afternoon is going to address, if we can't confront that and we can't find solutions, we're in a problem. And I think that's one of the challenges. There are so many people here who are interested in digital storytelling. How many of you are involved in teacher education? Raise your hand. Well, that's it. So if we can't come up with some solutions to your problem, I think that's a challenge that we need to set for ourselves.
Yeah, I think optimism and not understanding. I think the issue of this being scalable within the classroom, I mean, I took a part of my speech out that I wrote. It was actually me talking with the principal of my son's elementary school about these issues and the fight that she has in a public school to manage the testing and the prep. And it was very hard for her to, and we, you know, and she's like one of the best principals in America as far as I'm concerned. So there was a kind of, on the flip side, a kind of truth-telling about how difficult this is when even me, two blocks away from the school, my son's there and I should be able to help, how difficult it is to actually implement. So I don't think we should underestimate it, and I appreciate Mike saying that.
And there's some work being done on digital storytelling as authentic assessment. And then the step up from that is being able to communicate to the administration that this interdisciplinary approach that can take time, I mean, it's back to using projects, and take time is worth what they learn in the end, and being able to show that they are learning things that are connecting to their standards.
Yeah, right. We'll keep working on that question. Yeah?
One of the things I can do is work collaborate with healthcare industry to train healthcare workers, especially long-term care homes, training in dementia care or interdisciplinary education or pain management, whatever it is. And we do a lot of online development of courses. So we typically use Slash and innovative and engaging, but often in certain there we have videos. And after seeing your stories, I've never done digital storytelling, I can see that the videos are very outdated, and often you're a doctor, a nurse, and a pharmacist discussing really badly, role-playing. And so most of the scenarios stories you showed were historical memoirs, and except the eighth one, which got me to think that maybe you could use
If you can come up with a subject, I'll tell you where to go. So here's the, you go to the Australian Center for the Moving Image, in which they have a long-term project dealing with Alzheimer's care, and they've developed this as a public health policy project with the provincial, Victoria, the province government, to use digital storytelling as a method of training in this context. And we don't have posted this work that we're doing with foster youth, which has a kind of relationship to a number of issues of care, but it's also being used, these are becoming the training tapes, and they're so much more authentic and direct that for people that are working in the whole state-appointed caregivers in foster care and the whole counselor world of foster care, this has become a really obvious thing. Finally, there is a DVD I'm walking around with called Patient Tape. What's it called? Patient Stories? Anyway, there's a project in the UK that's going intensive. And this, the final thing I say is I'm on a national project that I'm developing with the service employees. And most of that's going to be based in healthcare. So we've already captured stories of people working at the Los Angeles Public County Hospital, King Drew Hospital in Compton, as part of a process of telling stories. They'll be used again in training and advocacy, in development of you know, in this case, you know, rank and file activism around the issues facing the crisis of public health. You know?
So the Alzheimer's one.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm sending you there first, is that those movies are sitting there, and links to the people doing that are sitting there. Australian Centre for the Moving Image. And just follow the links to digital storytelling, and you'll find those stories.
And that link is available on the blog as well.
Yeah. Yeah, they just did a major conference in Melbourne this last month.
There's also a body of research from the nursing field about storytelling. And
yeah, in a larger sense, yeah.
To, as reflective practice and to heal and talk about, you know, nurses after they got on their shift that they share the stories and things. But that's a really good, I mean, there's a lot of articles and a lot of research.
I saw this one first.
So, mind you, throw out a topic and I'll tell you where to go.
Yeah. Yeah. The last part may be true.
At risk for not graduating, passing high school assessments, dropping out, and I think this would be a great tool to engage them more in the learning process.
Yeah.
Do you know anybody who's been working on
that? We started a project with something called Streetside Stories in San Francisco. Streetside Stories is a arts education organization that's been going into San Francisco public schools, 7th and 8th grade, for many years. In a writing project, the end result was a book that would be of students writing. But they started a program they called Tech Tales with us in the last year. But more importantly, what they've been doing is tracking the students, working with WestEd, which is one of our educational research organizations in San Francisco. And WestEd is going to be writing both a quantitative and qualitative analysis of the impact on these students. So I can guarantee you the schools we're going into are the low achieving, difficult schools. I don't know what I think. I mean, having assisted with one of the work, I think, you know, this has got to be part of a larger process. I haven't seen anyone do a kind of end-to-end research of achievement in relationship to this. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence that it's a very good process for people that don't feel like they feel insignificant in the educational process, and this is a way to give significance to their own story, as complicated that might be. I know I've worked with dyslexic youth in the context of telling their stories and bringing their parents in, who often had similar stories, and mapping those together as just a kind of bridge-building thing. But most of that was done in after-school environments or special high school environments where they've already been pulled out, and so in my own experience, I know it was very powerful, but I don't think any of us should, you know, there's no magic bullet other than I think feeling insignificant can kill you, and this is a good cure, or at least a stopgap to give you some thoughtfulness about, you know, what your life has already given you. So that would be my argument. But, you know, so the Streetside Stories And unfortunately, I don't think they have their stories on the web. They will sell you the DVD of their movies. And streetside.org is the contact. And so you could buy, they put 35 movies on the DVD last year, and there should be another 35 stories. And I don't know why they didn't web publish them. I mean, I talked to them about it. But the DVD is quite wonderful. So, I saw this now.
Would you talk a little bit more about school reform and how digital storytelling could fit into it? Because you just mentioned your own high school and how I think time pressure and curricular pressure and just all the feel that I don't have time for this. This is great. Mm-hmm. I see how valuable it is, but I simply don't have time for it. We've got schools all over the place talking about redesign, and digital storytelling seems to fit right in with many of the things that schools say they want to do, which is get kids involved, learning in depth, you know, connect to their own experiences, be relationally connected. So can you talk about how digital storytelling, if you were going to make suggestions, for instance, to somebody redesigning a school, wanting kids to be doing this, this might be an outcome that you want to see kids do, what would your suggestion
be? Yeah, I mean, I think all of us have felt, and I talked about this for higher ed, but the idea that you bookmark important stages of your academic career, so going back to portfolio assessment, with stories that are about who you are at that moment, who you became at this moment, who you went that moment. It seems to me that there's a pretty good argument for those kinds of snapshots of students' experience. And they certainly could be done in a way that speaks to learning processes in a kind of, you know, Bruner sense or Gardner sense, that could be part of the way you connect a digital story in. You know, where do I think it's actually going to grow, ironically, is in a kind of fallback to vocational ed. And I see this in California in what is the county ROP program, which is the kind of vocational support mechanism that the county gives students that are, I don't know whether they're tracking that way or by whatever reasons they're moving toward a vocational career. And media production, which used to be, in the 90s, it was a cool thing to do, and now it's, as it's outsourced, you know, it's, you know, we call them in the Bay Area paint monkeys, you know, people that do digital media design. And the idea is that you may see a lot of people learning digital storytelling because it's assumed to be something that you can make a little money on. Not a lot of money, but a little money on. And the irony is, I mean, and I'll go back to my own high school, because my son's 10 years old, he's in fifth grade. At my local high school, the ROP program, and Apple had this on their front page, has this incredible video lab. And the videos at this Albany High School, I'm a proud citizen of my own town, are just incredibly good, you know, that are being done with the, you know, best Xserve servers and, you know, full bandwidth across the lab. So, you know, to me that tells me something. It tells me that somebody's working out a way for these students to do self-expression, but it's ironically coming out of this kind of vocational ed space, which, you know, someplace in the NCLB world is, you know, old school, you know, track them down and give them a job, you know. But I think there could be totally interesting transformations as a result of that. That's a guess on my part, as opposed to the high academic, you know, get them into Harvard as quickly as you can. That, I think, is still going to be really complicated because this seems so soft. Meanwhile, everybody, you know, the kids get in the Harvard and they slit their wrists because they're insane. They've been pressured to whatever, and they haven't checked in with themselves in years. And actually, they graduate and become people like you. So.
That was good.
No. Kidding. Just kidding. You're all mentally well, I'm sure. go ahead, Chris.
You're traveling, you know, all over the United States, in fact, all over the world, offering workshops as well as involving particularly groups of people in with projects that revolve around digital storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Where are all the funds coming from? In some instances, I know for a particular training, somebody like me can pay, you know, can't get my institution to cover, but you're also working with folks who can't pay.
Right.
And I think you are.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, even with, let's say, institutional support for someone like me, and I think others in here, mm-hmm. are there particular funds that we can tap, particular agencies that are friendly, or what?
Bernard, answer that question. No, I mean, from your experience at the University of Houston.
Well, what we've done in Houston is we Houston Endowment is the largest private philanthropic organization based on real estate and oil money
in
Houston. And we made a case that we wanted to, our grant was to hire full-time doctoral students who could go out into the community and spread the word with teachers and community partners about how to use technology in an innovative manner. And digital storytelling kind of evolved out of that. I mean, they were very supportive of us, but that money is actually about to run out, and we're now looking for how to follow up with that. But I would say small partners as well as one large partner would be an effective strategy as well. If you can find, and I don't know what the big technology vendors are doing these days to support people like us on small scales, but I think places like Adobe and Apple and even Microsoft, HP, they all have grant programs, I believe, that you can try to get. And I think if you could, what we've been able to do is leverage a big grant with other smaller things. And I think that's what funders like. Mm-hmm. They like to feel like what you're doing is important enough so it's not just them, just that one funding agency that is mm-hmm. funding everything. So what we've done with our Houston Endowment grant is gone to other places to try to get more money. And hopefully that's, we're still waiting to hear. Hopefully
that's
happening. Michael, you're welcome. In higher education, I think, in part, that's an obligation that we have. And if you have any partnerships with K-12 districts, which we do, and I know things are tightening up with grants, but we now have a third grant that we use, and CDS will come to our campus, and we generally buy half to two-thirds of the seats, mm-hmm. and we sponsor classroom teachers. And we just use the existing professional development funds that we have that allows us to work with school districts to support this type of thing. So I think look at what you've had. Bernard has been successful in going out and getting money. In general, when you go after money, it's relatively easy, if you're going to get it for a College of Ed, to throw in PD work that you're going to do with the districts, and then this type of work qualifies for it. And I really do think that if we're in that position to leverage this, we should. And I believe it's our obligation, and we share as much as we can with people in the community, and particularly.
I mean, my only other comment is that we've seen in some communities, I mean, this goes back to jobs, that there's a link between this and economic development issues. And we're trying, particularly as we kind of think about the story of a place as a kind of civic awareness, that capturing stories of place is part of community design and a kind of charrette process of assessment of community development. We think there's going to be more resources in that space, and that's something to look for, both I think from the private sector as well as the public sector, because as communities are renovated and changed and altered, then capturing the stories are part of that process. New Orleans is an example where we were doing work in a high school there prior to Katrina. That didn't happen this year, obviously, but a number of the people that we work with in New Orleans have been looking at the way storytelling will be integrated into, the grand civic process of redesigning and reappropriating the city back to the people, as it's been somewhat removed. But those are, they're resources in that context, obviously, but I think in other contexts, that economic development money might be an argument. Yeah.
My name is Paulette.
Hi, Paulette.
Is there any? Well, I tried it last semester with a group of four at the University of Graduate Students. Okay. And is there such a thing in your experience as storytelling books? I think from your comments this morning, mm-hmm. I'm not doing the list.
Well, that in that book that walked in the door, this is my one shameless plug. The creative writing world uses a prompting method, and there are obviously prompts that get to the heart quicker than others, and sometimes you just kind of have to see what you get out of a kind of quick write, and then let it go from there. Part of it is, of course, if we're a library and you've been locked up and you unleash it, it's a fire hydrant coming at you, and decisions can be difficult. But the idea of a decisive moment in one's life at almost any age that can be framed as change, and to me, when you have noticed that you have changed, and you have awareness, you've lived the story enough that you know how to tell it. You're not in the middle of change, but you're changed, and you can look back and talk about my life was headed in this direction, with this direction. Then you usually are at the heart of an important story for the person. So sometimes it can be as when my the street side. When my little brother was born, when my little sister was born, off goes the story of change. And clearly that's a decisive moment for all older siblings. I'm a youngest sibling, so I care less. But, just that idea of let them talk about the tensions and issues of the sibling rivalry as a place to focus. I mean, again, a 7-year-old can do that as well as a 28-year-old. And you can go there. So just that kind of prompting focus in a quick ride on a 4x6 card, and then listen. And like I do think, is just off of one writing exercise and really listening. A group, never mind one expert, but a group can go, no, it's right there when you said that. What the BBC uses is 10 things I love and 10 things I really hate. And now read the list. They do love and nobody pays much attention. Then they do hate and they go, that one, like, where did that come from? Because then they say, I really hate that, Then you say, where's the story? So they pull that out. Again, a method that they're using with people whose, literacy level is maybe very low. But they got a story. So they may not even write the 4x6 card, but they can make a list. So again, that prompting method, and there's lots of good books on creative writing prompts, that are, I think, useful. But yeah, you may be, I hear people say that. It's like, how do you get to deeper writing? It's deeper listening and appealing back. And again, from a mature place, if somebody has a story they don't want to tell, you don't make them tell it. But, you kind of go, you should probably dig into that one a little for this audience at an appropriate level for this audience. Other thoughts? Questions? Yeah, Bernard.
Can you talk a little bit about copyright and how you deal with it?
Yeah.
Just let me frame the question a little bit. In my experience, every middle school student and high school student on technical storytelling, the very first thing they do is they go and find a lot of images from Google, and then they get a CD of their favorite song, and they
that's what I did.
MTV video.
Sorry.
And they think, isn't this great? And it, it may be great. It may be on the way to greatness, but I think, in my opinion, they have to maybe go through that process. But then, they may even come up with something, but they're using a song from Green Day or Hoopa Stank or whatever it is, and they're using these pictures and sometimes clips of movies or TV shows. And, I personally think that's a good thing for them to get engaged and motivated and, figure out how to take things with pieces of multimedia or whatever. But I think I'm in the minority.
Well, we were talking about there's the public forum of digital storytelling and then there's the speakeasy. Can I see that on your iPod? We're probably ahead of the speakeasy movement, meaning like this issue of you processing the world you know as a kind of sampling media literacy project and making sense out of all that in some way. Some of it's kind of not much thinking, meaning making a music video is no thinking, but kind of integrating it in interesting ways is an important processing that we've seen students do. And pop culture is so completely part of their lives, their ability to comment on or reflect on, like William Shatner or something, is a kind of important process. So I think we should privilege that as a legitimate fair use space. Then I'll say, people should be creative artists and should own their material, and they should find a way to make work that they can own. I mean, we, in the Texas project that Linda Lothar, the woman in Texas, that was all clean. And it was just a little bit more creative work. You can tell ours are clean because you see people of, like, shots of shoes or walking or, you see these video clips that fill space. That means we had to get copyright. So on the South Africa one and the Texas one, we had to get copyright. But to me, that's like creative thinking and creative problem solving as part of the process. It adds a layer, and the BBC, must spend three times what we spend to get clean material, right? It adds a layer. I think we're going to get smarter, and I mentioned the Glenn Bull project of this online tool, your primary access, where you're using the available things on the web, but it's not really outputting. It's kind of just playing through your window, but it's your movie. I didn't quite wrap my head around that until yesterday, and I went, that's right. It's not your material. It could be, because they're also tying it into a Flickr account, but it's like, maybe that's an appropriate way for us to kind of bridge those, quote, concerns for online publication, because I don't really think you have to publish everything.
Matt's story about his grandmother.
Right.
Her story was shit. It had some New Age family music.
George Winston.
Yeah, that sounded very familiar.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the kind of story I think that we would all love to be able to go back home and be able to.
We should just strip that George Winston out and sit down with, GarageBand, and, because Linda Lothar's end piece, that nice New Age progression, was Amy Hill, who I didn't even know could play piano, made that in GarageBand on the fly. And to me, that just kills the end of that piece. It's just like, my heart stops. So it's to me that what we're trying to figure out is how to do that. And I know schools and big institutions have figured it out quite healthily, but it's just a slight chance. And again, going back to the original question, we've got to bring this into school. Burden. It's like, I've got to do clean, and we've got to help these kids for weeks figuring out their images or whatever. It's like, just get it done. Let them have the experience and then throw it away and say, the next one, you got to do clean.
A follow-up question, though, I'll shut up after this. Is there any benefit, or is it even a rational thought to think of that concept of moving home and saying, here's what we did with the George Winston piece, and here's what we want to share.
It's been done. Yeah. No, it could be. And we could do that on that one.
I don't know what they say.
Beatles and U2 you can't get, matter what. But, But, and the big institutions have figured that out. In the BBC, the BBC can do that with music. They've ended up not bothering as much and using their own court musician that comes along with them on their, to do the work. But it's being worked out at the level of, BMI, ASCAP, the kind of argument of, like, fair use of this stuff. And I think, again, the online copyright-free Creative Commons license world is being explored a little bit more and the possibilities there. But I still like to think that there's a kind of sub-workshop thing in GarageBand and kind of these instant things that it's where it should go. But, a lot of our work's first blush, right? Now, you never know to done anything even close to this. And I still argue, it's like, don't put too many obstacles the first time, even if the movie, if the movie gets as good as Matt's, we should fix it. And, we were doing a project with Kodak, and we had to go back and not only get it all clean, but get model releases for everybody in the picture. There was one shot of 28 people. We had to get model releases, all 28. They paid us well, so we didn't complain that much, but what a nutty idea, So, it can be done. And if something is being called to be used, then do it, you know, then figure it out. But in the meantime, use it as an experiment until you get better. Anything else?
Is there a body of curriculum-based digital stories?
Yeah.
No.
As far as I know, there's not one where I can look across the. I would love that idea. Now, there's a good idea. Go ahead.
No. You can answer my question.
Yeah. I would love that idea. I mean, meaning this body could do it. Is there one?
There's a
UH? That makes sense.
Content-specific repository, but we don't yet have the disciplines of other content areas coming together.
Yeah, I think that would
be another
question.
This afternoon,
mm-hmm. Bingo.
Is working with something
yeah.
like that.
I mean, yeah. the folks that have been working mm-hmm. with, and help me remember, the LOC program is called American Portrait?
American Memory.
So folks out of Mars Hill College and a few other places have been working on developing these stories in the mode of what we're saying with Sarah and Glenn and that kind of project, the primary source. They've been using LOC material. A lot of that got published on the LOC website. So that, in some ways, I would certainly call it digital storytelling by any other name. So social studies, it seems pretty obvious. That's a natural fit.
In English?
English, one would think. There are people here doing math. There are people here doing science. Mm-hmm. So I put the challenge back to site that this is something that you guys should do across the curriculum, bang it against the standards, and Jessica goes in with this on her back and just kicks the door down mm-hmm. of the administration.
Yeah.
Says, it's right here.
I'm just listening and then jotting down a thought as it occurs to me. And you prompted me to ask myself the question, how did I learn to solve this problem in order to show or demonstrate to others? If we could look at a curriculum and say, what is the not sort of necessarily the standard, but what are we expected to teach, what's in our syllabus, irrespective, and then ask ourselves the question, how did I learn, and meaning like how did I as an adult, or better yet, how did I as a 7th grader or a 12th mm-hmm. grader learn to solve this problem, mm-hmm. and is it possible mm-hmm. to show that, to mm-hmm. demonstrate that, and can I then say at what moment, this is your life, mm-hmm. At what moment did I make the change where I went, I learned it, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if that gets at creating that kind of
business. Yeah, I mean, those of you who bumped into the Emilia-Romagna system that's used for preschool mm-hmm. young people, it's a form of self-documentation in Reggio Emilia. Yeah, I'm sorry. The town is Emilia-Romagna. The program is called Reggio Emilia. This idea that we saw demonstrated because we were living in Italy, of the young people photographing their problem solving. Think of a Montessori classroom and you have the little project. And the students will take pictures of their way through the process. And what they're saying is, I got to the point of change, of getting it, and here's what I did. But they'll literally either draw or take pictures mm-hmm. of the process and stick it on the wall.
And the teachers record their narrative.
And the teachers record the narrative. So that the idea, again, from a Gardner argument or whatever, that each of us have different learning approaches in any normal environment where there's a teacher who believes the right way is the way to do it. This teaches the teacher to see there's a lot of ways in, and more important, it gets the student to own their own sense of learning process. I solve it this way. I use these methods. Extend that across any number of stories, right? Because those are narrative. I had a desire to solve the problem. I took action. In resolving the action, I had insight. That's the narrative core idea of a narrative structure. In any of those, you could go back and snapshot, you know. And it could be 4 pictures and 1 minute worth of text, or, you know, just interviewing the student. To me, that would be a really interesting idea. But again, goes back to assessment and, you know, the thoughts about portfolio, you can see the way you're learning over time. And I, you know, I think we've seen this. Where I've liked this, speaking to you guys as adults, is projects where we've worked with teachers who do this as teacher researchers in their own classroom. So they can look, go back and look at moments in change in a given school year. And I've done this several times with teachers both in the Bay Area and a national project we did. And I found those stories completely captivating about the way teachers work, you know, and the way they survive and the way they, you know, make sense of their own learning processes within the school. So, and some of those are available, but the Spencer Grant ones are someplace on the web. National Writing Project was involved in that. So.
NPR has a powerful session or show they're doing called This I Believe now.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be great to do one on This I Believe about teachers and the power of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And teacher impact stories, when you ask people to tell a story about the teacher that impacted them, really get to the heart of what's important in teaching and learning.
Mm-hmm.
Amidst NCLB and all this other stuff.
Right.
Is there any kind of project that you've seen where people are doing that kind of teacher impact? Tell me about the teacher, why that story.
I remember when that teacher handed out my Stanford 9 test. How important that moment was to me. Nah, haven't seen that story. Funny, the Department of Education is not underwriting those stories. I haven't seen it, obviously. It's as we presented today, it's a subject of a lot of stories that come our way. And it's not just the ones that are, you know, feel like they have to speak to educators. It's a huge point of change. A mentor in a school is a huge point of change for a lot of us. So I think, again, it could be its own NPR series. So why don't you pitch it as a separate NPR series about what is a good educator? And maybe that would be the first chip in the crack of this standardized craziness.
I know Nickleby, that's what we shorthand call it in South Dakota, NCLB Nickleby.
Mm-hmm.
Nickleby has a very negative impact a lot across the country, but on the reservation, it has been the best thing that's come our way.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of teachers on the reservation still doubt it because of some of the testing procedures and standardizing and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But from the perspective of me as a teacher being on the reservation for 4 years,
mm-hmm.
when I first came out there, if a parent did not like you,
mm-hmm.
they'd go to the school board, and regardless of what you were doing in the classroom, you were out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can't let go of us so
mm-hmm.
easily because, first of all, they're hard to replace,
mm-hmm.
licensed teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they need to make sure that the teachers that are in the classroom are trying to do the things that we need to do
mm-hmm.
to get good education to our
mm-hmm.
kids. And a lot of the teachers that we have that were not doing it are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so our testing is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that even at this point, and we've done some major programs and institutionalizing some different things, we're still at entering high school from a fourth to sixth grade reading level.
Sure.
So while, when I hate
no,
to,
I know,
you
of
know,
course. Yeah.
But now to get back onto your digital storytelling,
right?
I see it as a cross-curricular activity.
Mm-hmm.
And you can address so many different
standards
if you can get three teachers to work together, your technology teacher, your English teacher, and in our case, our Lakota language and culture teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I could see our Lakota language teachers just loving this and eating it up because they can get their kids to talk about their family and the culture that's within their family. I see the English teachers loving it because they have a hard time getting their kids to be creative appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it because then I can bring in the technology aspect, which I'm supposed to teach them in STEM skills anyway.
Right.
So I see it's a cross-curricular activity, and if you can bring in two or three or four teachers, you can hit so many more standards.
Yeah. No, I mean, all of us are having to do it. And there's going to be accountability
mm-hmm.
So these issues will be in some form or another. And again, in some ways I like the European model of the morning is when you do all that hard stuff, in the afternoon you get to do all the fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wish, you know, we still had the hard stuff. We are trying to get everybody to a place that we're supporting the people that are trying to get people. But there's we're not doing it at the expense of the arts and the project-based, you know, we're not doing it at the expense of those mm-hmm. things, and kind of figure out how to, you know, square the machine in order to do things that we know are valuable. They may not be more valuable than the other part, but they're valuable. Yeah, question.
It's easy to see that you are immersed in your passion. I want to know, at least one of your passions.
Yeah.
I want to know, what do you want to do new or differently over the next 5 years? Where do you see yourself going? You know, what are the things that you know that are the
I had my laptop, throw it up there. I mean, I almost could do it, but right as soon as my lecture was over, was back. So I thought if I had more time, if somebody asked me that question, I actually had the next four PowerPoints.
Let's do it.
No.
Sure.
No, because I can talk about it, okay. and I think people get the references. Well, one I mentioned, which is the idea of the civic process of story listening, story catching, story mining, is one that I think around the Pinionsville walls, Storiesville bridges, we need a lot of that, and we need new ways of civic conversation. So in that part of the speech that I left out, I said, imagine in your academic environment that you spend 1 week, one session in your monthly meeting just doing a story circle. Boy, would that be hard to organize in the current world, but we believe that people are going to need to begin to build into these structures ways that people just do sharing. You know, what was, you know, the moment of change for you in your academic life? Have you heard that from your colleagues ever, their story? I mean, what is often in our workshops, people are telling stories, I didn't know, I've been working with you for 15 years, and I didn't know that about you, you know. So, you know, or, you know, what's the trauma? What's the, appropriately shared in a group of safety, suddenly people who have been ragging on each other and pissed at each other and stressed out and grumpy in 100 ways are suddenly forgiving because they realize there's a lot more going on inside that head and body than I knew, and I'm going to now listen to what they're saying with that story in mind, and it changes the conversation. I think that's a universal process, so I'm excited about that. More technologically, the thing I'm just totally stuck on is called Murmur, which is a Canadian group that grew out, I was given credit for this even, I was glad to hear this. We worked to create a story-based curriculum for the Media Links Habitat component of the Canadian Film Center, which is in Toronto. Norman Lear, remember? Mm-hmm. All in the family, right? Norman Lear created a film center. And when the 90s came, they created a new media center within the film center. Each of the cohorts, a group of 20 kids, goes through the program and they create projects that they can commercialize. Group came in with a simple idea. We need to get stories, but it needs to be more accessible to people. So how do we distribute them? And maybe we should do stories about place. And what if there were signs around Toronto where you just called the number and punched in this thing and it says, look to your left. At that house in the 1970s, this was like one of the most important places in town for punk rock activity, and upstairs was a Buddhist terrorist group that, you know, and you hear these stories and you walk around the neighborhood and there's another sign and there's another sign, you go on the web and there's the map and you can see what they've done. These things in Toronto, in Montreal, in Vancouver, we're starting in San Francisco. It's such a simple idea with a universal William Shatner. I just grew up with, you know, live long and prosper. Murmurtoronto.ca is the website. Murmurtoronto.ca. And they have the recorded stories. They don't do a great job of the writing. It's a very simple interview process. Some of it's kind of sloppy, but it's often quirky and funny. But the idea is such a killer idea. So we've promoted this in New Orleans. We've promoted this in, you know, we're going to try to do something this summer at the ASEA conference in San Jose. This idea is just the right idea because we know it's about 2 minutes from now when these things also are like the iPod videos, right? So you could call up that same thing as a digital story if you wanted, and it could be on your phone, you take it home and let, you know, you don't have to, but if you're in space, you could be in an audio tour of anywhere on the planet without GPS. I mean, it's just a phone number, you know. you make those calls, you make those connections. This is a great idea to extend the idea of the ghost. This is my, one of the, you know, the ghosts of place are everywhere. And I've had a few really profound experiences in my life about places speaking to me, meaning that we're beyond the psychic territory. And I'm an old Marxist, so I don't believe in any of this stuff. But to me, the ghosts that are in any place speak to us in weird ways. And if the stories were embedded of a neighborhood where the ghosts are, boy, we'd be there. We'd be in the neighborhood in the way the old people are in the neighborhood, in the way other people who live there. And we're no longer tourists. And this is a really critical thing in the world where it's all jumbled up right now. So this is the big one to me. The final thing is what StoryCorps is doing. I think all of you know what StoryCorps is. StoryCorps was the guy named Dave Isay, who was a radio producer for WBAI, award-winning, you know, MacArthur guy, set up a booth in Madison Square Garden. People come in with a friend, you record oral history, you get your CD, the Library of Congress gets your story. Set one up at Ground Zero. Took it on the road this year with Saturn and NPR supporting it. We want to try to figure out how to collaborate in that idea of the touring storymobile, but adding multimedia and the scrapbook to the it's the one component they couldn't do. And we actually did something called the Great Canadian Story Engine, which was similar. Before Murmur, that was the story project came from one of the earlier classes in Toronto. So I think something like that with StoryCorps would be, I mean, kind of the great national tour. And part of that is linked to a project called Story America that we've been collaborating with the National Storytelling Festival folks in the International Storytelling Center in Jonesboro, Tennessee. So, we've been trying to figure out how to lock all that together and create, either with StoryCorps or with the same kind of arrangement, that kind of event, because I think that would be great. So maybe we'll do it on teacher stories.
We're just about out of time, and I know some of you in other sessions, but Joe does have his book available, and I'm going to be presumptuous, but I know Joe well enough that he'd be willing to sign them if you'd like to.
I would sign them.
Okay, so these are available up
well,
here.
I'll not sign them if you not want me to sign them. You want to keep them clean? Yes, we want to get rid of them. They were $20 today only. At the site conference, $25, going up to $30 when the new edition comes out in a little bit, but it won't change that much, so don't wait for the new edition. Not today. Because I ain't carrying these puppies back.
Thank you
guys.
Are you really?
Yeah.